I smiled at her, my beautiful black-haired girl. Nope. Did they teach you how to do that in medical school? Kevin asked. Neither of the children had sunburns. Celeste had been careful with them, and not herself. Sure, I said, aware for the first time how glad I was that it hadn't been my son's foot pinned to the sand. One semester there's a class on pulling boys' feet off nails at beaches, and the next semester you learn how to save people who've choked on fish bones. What medical school had taught me was how to be decisive, identify the problem, weigh the options, and act, all at the same time. But then real estate had taught me the same thing. I would have pulled Andy Gilbert's foot off the nail without a single day of anatomy. You shouldn't make light of it, my wife said. You knew what to do. May and Kevin stopped. Kevin held an ear of corn in one hand. May put down her fork. We were waiting for her to say it. We looked at Celeste and waited. She shook her head, her curls somehow lighter after a single afternoon of the sun. Well, it's true. You're a doctor, May said, leaning forward and leveling her eyes at me. You should be a doctor. May could do all of this, but she'd made her impression of Celeste into high art. It didn't matter that we were living a very good life, a life my friends from medical school would never know unless they sold off pages from their prescription pads. Celeste would have preferred to introduce me as a doctor, my husband, Dr. Conroy. In fact, she used to do it despite my requests. She'd knock it off. My title was the source of most of the arguments we had that weren't about my sister. But that night in bed, Celeste stretched out on top of me, her head against my shoulder, every argument worn out of her by the day. Do my spine, she said. She hadn't taken her shower yet, and she still smelled like the ocean, the wind coming over Brighton Beach. I reached my fingers beneath her hair and felt the base of her skull. Atlas, axis, first cervical vertebra. I pressed each one like a piano key, touch and then release, counting all seven. Thoracic. You've got to do a better job with the sunscreen. Hush, don't ruin it. Thoracic. I counted out the 12, then I got to the lumbar. I rubbed deep circles in her lower back until she made soft, cow-like sounds. Do you remember? She asked. Of course I remember. I loved the weight of her spread across me, the terrible heat coming off her skin. All those years I helped you study. All those years you kept me from studying. I kissed the top of her head. You were a great doctor, she whispered. I was no such thing, I said. But she raised her face to mine all the same. Years and years after medical school was behind me, when some buildings I had bought and sold had turned enough of a profit to pay off our house and shore up our savings, I became fixated on the impossible notion of fairness. So much time and money had been wasted on my education while nothing had come to Maeve. There was already a trust in place for May and Kevin, so why shouldn't Maeve go to law school, business school? It wasn't too late for that. She had always been the smart one, after all. And whatever she decided to study, she could be a huge help to me. I'm already a huge help to you, she said. I don't need a law degree for that. Get a degree in mathematics, then. I'm the last person to tell you to study something you're not interested in. I just don't want to see you give your entire life to Otterson's. She was quiet for a moment. She was trying to decide whether or not she wanted to get into it. Why does my job bother you so much? Because it's beneath you. Everything in me leapt to tell her what she already knew. Because it's the job you got the summer you came home from college and you're 48 and you're still doing it. You were always pushing me to make more of myself. Why not let me return the favor? The madder Maeve got, the more thoughtful she became. In this way, she reminded me of our father. Every word she spoke came individually wrapped. If this is my punishment for sending you to medical school, fine. I accept that. I wasn't pushing you to make more of yourself anyway. I think you know that. But if you're saying you're interested in my livelihood, then let me tell you, I like what I do. I like the people I work with. I like this company I've helped to grow. I've got job flexibility, health insurance that includes vision and dental, and enough paid vacation saved up that I could go around the world. But I don't want to go around the world because I like my job. I don't know why I wasn't ready to let it go. You might like something else, too. You haven't tried. Otterson needs me. Can you get that? He knows a lot about trucking and refrigeration and a little about vegetables and absolutely nothing about money. Every day, I get to believe that I'm indispensable. So leave me alone. The full-time job she had at Otterson's, Maeve did in half the time. At this point, Otterson didn't care where she did her work or how much time she spent on it. She always got it done. He gave her the title of chief financial officer, though I couldn't imagine the company needed a CFO. She did the books for my business on the side and never gave it anything less than her full attention. Maeve's eye was on the sparrow. If a light bulb burned out in the lobby of a building I owned, she wanted a record of its replacement. Once a week, I mailed her a folder of receipts, bills, rent checks. She made note of everything in a ledger that was not unlike the one her father kept. We banked in Jenkintown, and Maeve's name was on all the accounts. She wrote the checks. She kept up with New York State taxes, city taxes, rebates, and incentives. She wrote firm and impartial letters to tenants who were past due. Once a month, I included a check for her salary, and once a month, she failed to cash it. I pay you, or I pay someone else, I said. And for someone else, this would be an actual job. You'd really have to hunt for someone who could turn this into a job. The work she did for me, she did over dinner at her kitchen table. On Thursdays, she said. Maeve had long lived in a rented red brick bungalow two blocks from Immaculate Conception that had two bedrooms and a deep front porch. The kitchen was sunny, outdated, and looked over a wide rectangular yard where she planted dahlias and hollyhocks along the back fence. There was nothing wrong with the house, really, other than it was too small, tiny closets, one bathroom. I don't care how rich you are, you can only use one bathroom at a time, Maeve said. Well, I'm here sometimes. Though it was the case, I very rarely slept over anymore. Maeve would have been the first to point this out. How many years did we share a bathroom? I offered to buy her a house in lieu of salary, but she refused that as well. She said no one was ever going to tell her where she could and could not live, not even me. It's taken me 5 years to get a decent crop of raspberries, she said. So I went to her landlord and bought the house she lived in. In my history of buying and selling property, it was doubtlessly the worst deal I ever made. Once it had been established that I wanted something that wasn't for sale, the owner was free to set an obscene price, and he did. Didn't matter. I dropped the deed in the weekly folder of bills and receipts and mailed it to her. Maeve, who was rarely excited and never surprised, was both. I've been walking around this place all afternoon, she said when she got me on the phone. A house looks different when you own it. I never knew that before. It looks better. No one's ever going to get me out of here now. I'm going to be like old Mrs. Van Hoobake. I'm going out feet first. I was heading back to the city, and on a lark, we stopped by the Dutch house for just a minute. This way we could miss the worst part of the late afternoon traffic on our way to the train. Behind the linden trees, two men on giant riding mowers were driving straight lines back and forth across the wide lawn. And we rolled down our windows to let in the smell of cut grass. We were both in our 40s then, me nearer the beginning and Maeve near the end. My trips to Jenkintown had long become routine. I took the train down in the morning on the first Friday of every month and came back the same night, using my commute to get in order the paperwork I was taking to Maeve. As much as the company was expanding, I could have easily gone every week to sift through bills and contracts with my sister. And I definitely should have gone twice a month. But every departure meant a struggle with Celeste. She said that this was the time to be with our children. Kevin and May still like us, Celeste would say. That's not always going to be the case. She wasn't wrong, but still, I couldn't stop going home, and I didn't want to. The compromise I made was heavily tilted in Celeste's favor, even if Celeste never saw it that way. Maeve and I had so much work to do when we were together that months would go by when the Dutch house scarcely crossed our minds. The fact that we were parked there now was really just an act of nostalgia. Not for the people we'd been when we lived in the house, but for the people we'd been when we parked on Van Hoebeek Street for hours smoking cigarettes. "Do you ever wish you could get back in the house?" Maeve asked. The mowing made me think of plows and mules. Would I go in if the house were on the market? Probably. Would I go up and ring the doorbell? No. Maeve's hair was going gray, and it made her look older than she was. "No, what I'm talking about is more like a dream. Would you go in by yourself if you could? Just to look around and see what happened to the place." Sandy and Jocelyn in the kitchen laughing while I sat at the blue table doing homework. My father with his coffee and cigarette in the morning in the dining room, a folded newspaper in his hand. Andrea tapping across the marble floor of the foyer. Norma and Bright laughing as they ran up the stairs. Maeve, a schoolgirl, her black hair like a blanket down her back. I shook my head. "No. No way. What about you?" Maeve tilted her head back against the headrest. "Not for anything. I think it would kill me if you want to know the truth." "Well, I'm glad you won't be invited back then." The light painted every blade of grass, turning the lawn into stripes the width of a lawnmower, dark green, light green, dark green. Maeve turned her head towards the view. "I wonder when we changed." We had changed at whatever point the old homestead had become the car, the Oldsmobile, the Volkswagen, the two Volvos. Our memories were stored on Van Hoebeek Street, but they weren't in the Dutch house anymore. If someone had asked me to tell them very specifically where I was from, I would have to say I was from that strip of asphalt in front of what had been the Buxbaum's house, which had then become the Schultz's house, and now was the house of people whose names I didn't know. I was irritated by the landscaper's truck, the lengthy metal trailer cutting into our spot. I wouldn't have bought a house on that street, but if the street itself was for sale, it would have been mine. I said none of that. All I said in answer to her question was that I didn't know. "You really should have gone into psychiatry," she said. "It would have been so helpful. Fluffy says the same thing, you know. She says she wouldn't go back either. She says for years she had dreams where she was walking from room to room in the Dutch house, and we were there. Her parents and Sandy and Jocelyn and all the Van Hoebeeks, and everyone was having a fabulous time. One of those big Gatsby-esque parties they used to have when she was a kid. She said for so long all she wanted was to get back in that house, and now she doesn't think she could go in there if the door were open." Fluffy had long been repatriated back into the fold. Sandy and Jocelyn and Fluffy and my sister were all together again, the staff of the Dutch house and their duchess, going out for quarterly lunches and taking apart the past with a flea comb. Maeve believed in the veracity of Fluffy's memories over Sandy's or Jocelyn's, or even her own, because Fluffy had walked away with her facts. Sandy and Jocelyn talked endlessly to each other, gnawing on the bones of our collective history along with my sister, but not Fluffy. After my father sent her to the end of the driveway with her suitcase, who could she have talked to? Her new employers? Her boyfriend? Even when she worked in our house, she told the stories Celeste liked to hear, the ones about the Van Hoebeeks, the parties, and the clothes. Celeste's attention wandered once the Conroy family took possession of the property, I think because Maeve was too firmly at the center of those chapters. But that was all for the better. Fluffy's stories had stayed fresh because she had kept them to herself. Fluffy still knew what she knew. "Fluffy told me Mommy wanted to be a nun," Maeve said. "Don't you think that would have come up at some point? She was already a novice when Dad came and pulled her out of the convent to marry her." Fluffy said they'd grown up in the same neighborhood. He was friends with her brother James. I told her we knew that we'd been out to Brooklyn when we were kids and found the apartment buildings where they lived. Fluffy said that Dad had gone to visit her before she took her vows, and that was that. All those times she used to go away before she left for good, she was going back to the convent. The nuns loved her. I mean, everybody loved her, but the nuns loved her especially. They were always calling Dad and telling him to let her stay for a few more days. She just needs some rest. That's what they'd say. That must have gone over well. The two lawnmowers were coming down the driveway and then out onto the street. A man motioned to Maeve to back up so they could pull onto the trailer. I have to say, I don't even care about it now, she said. But if I'd known that when I was growing up, I swear, I would have joined the convent just to irritate him. I smiled at the sudden picture in my mind of Maeve, tall and stern in her navy blue habit. I wondered if our mother was still out there, working in a soup kitchen somewhere, and if that was the part of her that wanted to be a nun. I should have told Maeve that story years ago when it happened, but I never had. The problem was compounded by the realization that I had waited too long. I'm sure that would have gotten his attention. Yeah, Maeve started the car and put it in reverse. That probably would have been the thing to do. Jesus, Celeste said later when I was trying to tell her the story. It's like you're Hansel and Gretel. You just keep walking through the dark woods, holding hands no matter how old you get. Do you ever get tired of reminiscing? I would go through long periods of my life in which I took a private vow to tell my wife nothing about my sister, to comment only on the weather in Jenkintown or the train ride home and leave it at that. But the strategy enraged Celeste, who said I was shutting her out. So then I would reverse myself, deciding she was right. Married couples told each other what was going on. No good came of secrets. In those periods, I answered her honestly when she asked me how my trip to Jenkintown was or what was going on with my sister. It never made any difference what I said. My answers, however benign, ignited her. She's nearly 50 years old. Is she really still thinking she's going to get her mother back? She's going to get her house back? That's not what I said. I said, she told me our mother had wanted to join the convent when she was young. I thought it was an interesting story. Period. Celeste wasn't listening. Where Maeve was concerned, she didn't listen. At what point do you say to her, okay, it was an awful childhood. It's a terrible thing to be rich and then not be rich, but now everybody has to grow up. I refrained from pointing out the things Celeste already knew, that her own parents were alive and well, still in the Norcross Foursquare and Rydal, still nursing the pain of having lost a succession of noble Labrador retrievers over the course of their long marriage, one of whom, years before, had darted out the front gate and was hit by a car in the springtime of her youth. They were good people, Celeste's people, and good things had happened to them. I wouldn't have wished it any other way. What I didn't appreciate was that Celeste took such issue with Maeve for not coming into the city, when Maeve coming to be with us was the last thing she wanted. She's too busy with her important job in frozen vegetables to come here for the day. She expects you to drop everything, your business, your family, and run to her when she calls. I'm not going out there to cut her lawn. She does all this work that she doesn't charge us for. Going out there seems like the least I could do. Every single time? What was never said but was perfectly clear was that Maeve had no husband, no children, and so her time was less valuable. You should be careful what you wish for, I said. I can't imagine you'd be happier if Maeve came here once a month. And while I was sure we were careening towards a full-on argument, this sentence stopped Celeste cold. She put her face in her hands, and then she started to laugh. My God, she said, you're right. Go to Jenkintown. I don't know what I'm saying. Maeve didn't have to give me a reason why she hated New York. Traffic garbage, crowding incessant noise, the omnipresent visible poverty. She could have her pick. When I finally asked her after many years of wondering, she looked at me like she couldn't believe I didn't know. What? Celeste, she said. You gave up the entire city of New York to avoid Celeste? What other reason would there be? Whatever injustices Maeve and Celeste had committed against each other years before had become abstractions. Their dislike for each other was a habit now. I could never help but think that had they met on their own, two women who had nothing to do with me, they would have liked each other very much. Certainly, they had at first. They were smart and funny and fiercely loyal, my sister and my wife. They claimed to love me above all others, while never acknowledging the toll it took on me to watch them pick each other apart. I blamed them both. They could have avoided it now. The grudge could be set aside if they made the choice. But they didn't. They clung to their bitterness, both of them. Even if Maeve didn't come to the city as a rule, she recognized that rules came with exceptions. She was there for May's and Kevin's first communions, and every now and then she turned up for a birthday. She was happiest when the children came to see the Norcrosses. Maeve was always invited to dinner. She would take Kevin home with her for the night and then to work with her in the morning. Kevin, who had no use for vegetables on his dinner plate, found them irresistible in frozen form. He couldn't get enough of the factory. He loved the order and precision of giant steel machines as applied to little carrots. He loved the chill that permeated the place, the people wearing sweaters in July. He said it was because Mr. Otteson's family was Swedish. Cold weather people, he said. He saw Mr. Otteson as the Willy Wonka of produce. Once he was satisfied by a day of watching peas being sealed into plastic bags, Maeve would return him to his grandparents, where he would immediately call his mother and tell her he wanted to work in vegetables. A day spent with Maeve bore no resemblance to a day spent with Kevin. Maeve wanted to go through photo albums with her aunt page by page, resting her finger beneath every chin and asking questions. "Aunt Maeve," she'd say, "were you really so young?" Maeve loved nothing more than to park in front of the Dutch house with her aunt, as if the pull to the past was an inherited condition. Maeve insisted that she, too, had lived there when she was very young, too young to remember. She layered fluffy stories about parties and dancing onto her own memories of childhood. Sometimes she said she'd lived above the garage with Fluffy, and together they drank the flat champagne, and other times she was a distant Van Hubeek relative, asleep in a glorious bedroom with a window seat she'd heard so much about. She swore she remembered. One night, Maeve called me after my daughter was asleep in her guest room. When I told her the house had a swimming pool, she was indignant. "It's so hot here, it must have been 100 today," and Maeve said, "I have every right to swim in that pool." "What did you tell her?" Maeve laughed. "I told her the truth, poor little egg. I told her she has no rights at all." Chapter 15. Maeve was very serious about her dancing in those days. She had secured a spot in the School of American Ballet when she was 8. We were told she had a high-end step and good turnout. Every morning she stood with one hand on the kitchen counter and pointed her toes to sweep a series of elegant half-circles, her hair pinned up in a high bun. Years later, she told us she saw ballet as her most direct route to the stage, and she was right. At 11, she landed a role in the Army of Mice in the New York City ballet production of The Nutcracker. While another girl might have wanted to wear a tulle skirt and dance with the snowflakes, Maeve was thrilled with her oversized fur head and long, whip-like tail. Miss Elise said that smaller companies reuse the children in different parts, Maeve told us when she was cast. But New York has too much talent. If you're a mouse, you're a mouse. That's all you're going to get. No small parts, her mother said, only small mice. Maeve stayed in character throughout the long autumn of rehearsals, keeping her hands curled beneath her chin as she scurried around the house, nibbling at carrots with her front teeth in a way that irritated her brother to no end. She insisted that her aunt come to see her on the New York stage, Maeve's phrasing, and her aunt agreed that this was exactly the sort of occasion for which rules were broken. Maeve made plans to bring Celeste's parents into the city for the first Sunday matinee. She would pick them up in Rydal, then drive to the train station so they could all come in together. One of Celeste's brothers lived in New Rochelle, and her sister was in the city, so they came with their families as well. We made a strong showing in the audience, considering there would be no way of knowing which mouse was ours. When the theater darkened and the audience ceased its collective rustling, the curtain rose to Tchaikovsky's overture. Beautiful children dressed as children never are came racing out to the Christmas tree, and the lights came up on a set that might as well have been the Dutch house. It was a kind of architectural mirage, if such a thing were possible. A visual misunderstanding that I knew wasn't true, but was still, for a moment, wildly convincing. Maeve was a half dozen seats away from me in the long row of the Norcross and Conroy families, so there was no leaning over to ask if she saw it too. The two giant portraits of people who are not the Van Hoobakes, each slightly turned in the direction of the other above an elaborate mantle. There was a long green settee. Had ours been green? The table, the chairs, the second sofa, the massive burled secretary with a glass front full of beautiful leather-bound books that all turned out to be written in Dutch. I remembered the first time I'd taken the key out of the desk as a boy and stood on a chair to open those glass doors. The amazement of taking down book after book and seeing my familiar alphabet arranged into a senseless configuration. The set of the ballet was like that. I knew the chandelier suspended above the stage. There was no mistaking it. How many countless hours had I spent on my back, staring into that chandelier, the light and the crystal, combining as I doubled down on my childhood attempts at self-hypnosis. I'd read about it at the library. Of course, the grouping of furniture had been flattened out, pushed back into an unnatural line in order to make room for the dancers. But were I able to go on stage and rearrange it, I could have recreated my past. In truth, it wasn't just the Nutcracker. Any configuration of luxury seen from a distance felt like a window on my youth. That's how far away youth was. Celeste was on my left, Kevin on my right, their faces warmed by the stage light. The party guests were dancing, and the children held hands and formed a ring around them. After they had all danced off into the wings and stage night fell, the mice made their entrance behind the evil Mouse King. They rolled around on the floor, kicking their little feet furiously in the air. I covered Celeste's hand with my hand. So many mice, so many children dancing. The soldiers of the Nutcracker came. The war was fought. Dead mice were dragged away by the living to make room for more dancers. There was a certain amount of storyline in the first act, but the second act was nothing but dancing. Spanish dancers, Arab dancers, Chinese dancers, Russian dancers, endless dancing flowers. Too much dancing wasn't a valid complaint to make about a ballet, but without the mice to look forward to, without the furniture to consider, I struggled to find meaning. Kevin poked my arm, and I leaned over to him. I could smell the butterscotch lifesaver in his mouth. "How can it be so long?" he whispered. I looked at him helplessly and mouthed the words, "No idea." Celeste and I had made a few half-hearted attempts to get the kids to church when they were young. Then we gave up and left them in bed. In the city of constant stimulation, we had failed to give them the opportunity to develop strong inner lives for those occasions when they would find themselves sitting through the second act of the Nutcracker. When at last the ballet was over and the Sugar Plum Fairy and the Nutcracker and Clara and Uncle Drosselmeyer and the Snowflakes each had their fair share of thunderous applause, no curtain call for the mice. The audience collected their coats and stood to make their way to the aisles, all except Maeve. She stayed in her seat, eyes straight ahead. I noticed my mother-in-law had her hand on Maeve's shoulder. Then she was leaning over to say something. There was a tremendous bustle of activity around us. Our family, standing without moving forward, was blocking the path. The grandmothers and mothers who had filled the row beside us turned their charges around to exit in the opposite direction. "Danny," my mother-in-law called. We were a significant group, a few Conroys and many Norcrosses, spouses, children, parents, siblings. I made my way past all of them. The sweat was beating on Maeve's nose and chin. Her hair was soaked through, as if she had slipped out for a swim while the rest of us watched the ballet. Maeve's purse was on the floor, and I found the same old yellow plastic box inside, now held together by a rubber band, and took two glucose tablets out of the little plastic bag she kept. "Home," she said in a quiet voice, still looking straight ahead, though her eyelids were drooping. I pushed a glucose tab between her teeth, and then another. I told her to chew. "What should I do?" my father-in-law asked. Maeve had picked them up and brought them in on the train because none of us liked the idea of Bill Norcross driving into the city. "Does she need an ambulance?" "No," Maeve said, still not turning her head. "She'll be okay," I said to Bill, like this was our routine. A very old calm settled on me. "I need," Maeve said, then closed her eyes. "What?" Then Celeste and Kevin were there with a glass of orange juice and cloth napkin full of ice. I hadn't seen them leave, and already they were back with what we needed. They had known. Standing in the row behind us, Celeste lifted the sopping wool of Maeve's hair and rested the ice pack against her neck. Kevin handed me the juice. "How did you get this so fast?" The aisles were packed with little girls and their minders excitedly recounting each jeté. "I ran," said my son, who had choked on his own excess of energy throughout the performance. "I said it was an emergency." Kevin knew how to move around people, a benefit of growing up in the city. I held my handkerchief under Maeve's mouth. "Sip. You know, this will make your sister insanely jealous that you were the one who got the juice," Celeste said to Kevin. "She would rather have been the hero than a mouse." Kevin smiled, his stoicism in the face of boredom rewarded. "Is she going to be okay?" "Okay," Maeve said quietly. "You get everyone out to the lobby," Celeste told her father, who, like Kevin, was looking for work. "I'll be there in 1 minute." Maeve pressed her eyes closed and then opened them wider. She was trying to chew the tablets and drink the juice with minimal success. Some of it was slipping from the side of her mouth. I gave the glass to Celeste and fished a test strip out of the yellow box. Maeve's hands were wet and cold when I stuck her finger. "What do you think happened?" Celeste asked me. Maeve nodded, swallowed. She was coming slowly into focus. "Danced so long." Everyone was always in such a hurry to leave a theater. They hoped to be the first to get to the bathroom, to get a taxi, get to the restaurant before the reservation was canceled. It had been scarcely 10 minutes since a raucous ovation and the distribution of roses, and already the giant New York State Theater was almost empty. The last of the little girls, the ones who had been sitting in the very front rows, came pirouetting up the aisle in their fur-collared coats. All those velvet seats had folded back in on themselves. One of the ushers stopped at our row, a woman in a white shirt and a buttoned green vest. "You folks need help?" "She's okay," I said. "She just needs a minute." "He's a doctor," Celeste said. Maeve smiled. Mouth the word doctor. The usher nodded. "If you need something, you let us know. We just need to sit here a while." "Take your time," the woman said. "I'm sorry," Maeve said. I wiped down her face. The test strip reported her sugar at 38. It should have been 90, and I would have been happy with 70. "You should have told someone you weren't feeling well." Celeste moved the ice to the top of Maeve's head. "Oh, that's good," Maeve said. "I didn't want to get up. I thought..." She inhaled deeply, closed her eyes. I told her to take another sip of juice. She swallowed, began again. "I'd be disruptive." Maeve was wearing a blouse with a sweater over it, wool slacks, all of it wet. Celeste had Maeve's hair gathered up in one hand, the ice pack in the other. "I'm going backstage to get May, and we'll go on to dinner," she said to me. "When she's feeling better, bring her over to the house." Danny should go, Maeve said. She still hadn't tried to look at either of us. Danny isn't going to go, Celeste said. There's a big crowd and no one will miss him. It's a detente, okay? You're sick. Maeve's going to want to see you, so plan on coming back to the house. She handed me the shards of ice, the sopping napkin. The glucose was doing its job. I watched the life come creeping back into my sister's face. Tell May she was a good mouse, Maeve said. You'll tell her, Celeste said. I have to get your parents home. Maeve's voice, which had a tendency to boom in other circumstances, was so light I don't know how Celeste could have heard her. It floated up towards the high ceiling. Celeste shook her head. Just do what Danny tells you for a change. I have to go. I leaned over and kissed Celeste. She was more than capable of rising to the occasion. She passed the ushers who were coming back down the aisles to pick up the scattered programs from the floor, sweeping the candy wrappers into their dustpans. Maeve and I sat together in the theater seats. She let her head rest on my shoulder. She was very nice, Maeve said. Most of the time she is. Détente, Maeve said. You're feeling better. A little, but it's good to sit. She took my handkerchief and blotted her face and neck. I took her hand and punched another hole in her fingertip to test her blood again. What is it? I peered at the strip. 42. We'll wait another minute. She closed her eyes. I looked across the sea of empty seats, inhaled the mix of perfumes hanging above us in the air. The mice and the snowflakes and the Christmas tree in the living room set, the audience who sat in the dark to watch. Everything was gone now. Everyone was gone. And it was just the two of us. It had been just a minor miscalculation. Maeve would be fine. I started to think I could put Maeve in my car and drive her around to see my buildings. I could drive her to Harlem and show her the very first brownstone I ever bought, and then go to Washington Heights and show her the health sciences building that sat on top of the two parking lots I had owned for 5 months. I could give her the entire tour. Maeve may have known my business to the last dime, but she'd never actually seen it. We could wind up at Café Luxembourg when we were finished, eat steak frites before going home. Kevin May would be so happy to have her in the house, and maybe Maeve and Celeste would see it was time to put it all to rest. If it was ever going to happen, then this would be the day, lost as we had been to the nutcracker, and then the precipitous drop in blood sugar. Celeste had come to her aid, after all, and Maeve had been grateful. Even the oldest angers could be displaced. After a glass of wine, if she felt up to a glass of wine, Maeve would climb the stairs to May's room, push the stuffed animals off the second bed so they could lie across from each other in the dark. Maeve would tell her what the world looked like from those two cut-out eye holes, and Maeve would tell her what she had seen from the 14th row. Upstairs in our own bed, Celeste would tell me it was okay that my sister was here, or better than okay. She'd finally been able to see Maeve as the person I had always known. No, Maeve said. Drive me home. Come on, I said. It's a big night. She picked at the neck of her sweater. I can't wear these clothes for the rest of the night. I don't even know if I can stand them on the drive home. I'll get you some clothes. Do you remember when I came and stayed with you in college? Dad dropped me off without a toothbrush, without anything. You took me shopping. Oh, Danny, are you serious? I can't go shopping, and I can't spend the evening talking to the Norcrosses about ballet. I can barely keep my eyes open sitting here. My car is at the train station. I have a meeting at work in the morning. I want to eat something and fall asleep in my own bed. She turned to me in her seat. Soon enough, we were going to wear out our welcome at the New York State Theater. She was right, of course. I should have been thinking about how I was going to get her to the lobby, not how we would take a tour of the city and stay up half the night. Fragility wasn't a word I could attach to my sister, but everything in her countenance made it clear. She took hold of my hand. I'll tell you what. You drive me home and spend the night. You haven't spent the night in how many years? In the morning, we'll get up before the birds. I'll be fine then. You can drive me to the station to get my car, then drive straight back to the city before the traffic. You could be home by 7. There wouldn't be anything wrong with that, would there? Celeste has her family here. There was plenty wrong with it, but I didn't know what else we could have done. While everyone was off at May's dinner, before the mouse-shaped cake that Celeste had taken over to the restaurant had been served, Babe and I took a taxi back to the house. I knew that May would be disappointed and Celeste would be furious, but I also knew how sick Maeve had been, how exhausted she was. I knew that she alone and all the world would have done the same for me. Maeve sat on a little bench we kept by the front door for pulling boots off and on in the winter, and I ran upstairs, packed a bag, and left a note. Maeve slept in the car most of the way home. It was early December, and the days were short and cold. I drove to Jenkintown in the dark, thinking all the time about the dinner I was missing, about May dancing in the mouse head. I called as soon as we got to Maeve's house, but no one answered. "Celeste, Celeste, Celeste," I said into the machine. I pictured her in the kitchen, looking at the phone and turning away. Maeve had gone straight in to take a bath. I made us eggs and toast, and we ate at her little kitchen table. When we went to bed, it wasn't even 8 o'clock. "At least we each have our own bedroom now," I said. "You don't have to sleep on the couch." "I never minded sleeping on the couch," she said. We said goodnight in the hallway, Maeve's second bedroom, doubled as her office, and I looked at the bookshelf full of binders that said Conroy on the spine. I meant to pull one down for kicks to take my mind off the disasters of the day, but then decided to close my eyes for just a minute. And that was that. When Maeve knocked on my door, she woke me from a dream in which I was trying to swim to Kevin. Every stroke I took towards him seemed to push him farther out until I was struggling to see his head above the water's chop. I kept calling for him to swim back, but he was too far away to hear me. I sat straight up, gasping, trying to make sense of where I was. Then I remembered. I had never been so happy to be awake. Maeve opened the door a crack. "Too early?" Now that it was morning, yesterday's plan seemed utterly sensible, necessary. Maeve in the kitchen was her own bright self, making coffee, telling me how fine she felt, like none of it had happened. "I just needed a bath and a good night's sleep," she said. I could see that I would be home early enough to make amends. We were outside in the dark again just past 4 o'clock, Maeve locking the back door of her little house. We were ahead of the schedule we had laid out for ourselves. Nothing would be lost. "Let's go to the house," Maeve said, once we were back in my car. "Really? We've never gone over there this time of day. We've never done anything this time of day. It's not like we're going to be late." She had so much energy. I had forgotten the way she was in the morning, like each new day came in on a wave she had managed to catch. The Dutch house wasn't far from where Maeve lived, and since it was in the general direction of where we were going, and since we had gotten up so early, I didn't see how there was any harm in it. The neighborhoods were dark, the street lights on. It wouldn't be light until after 7. I had left New York in the dark, and I would get home before it was light again. That wasn't too bad. The houses on Van Hubeek Street were never entirely dark. People left their porch lights on all night, as if they were always waiting for someone to come home. Gas lights flickered at the ends of driveways. A lamp in the front window of a living room stayed on through the night. But even with all these small bursts of illumination, there was a stillness about the place that made it clear the inhabitants were all in their beds. Even the dogs of Elkins Park were asleep. I pulled the car into our spot and turned off the engine. The moon in the west was bright enough to drown out any stars. It poured over everything equally, the leafless trees and the driveway, the wide lawn scattered with leaves, and the wide stone stairs. Moonlight poured across the house and into the car where Maeve and I sat. When would I have seen this as a boy, up hours before dawn on the clear, cold winter night? I would have been like everyone else in the neighborhood, sound asleep in my bed. "You'll tell May and Kevin I'm sorry," Maeve said. We were in the car together, each of us deep in our separate thoughts. It took me a minute to realize she was talking about the Maui and the dinner after. They won't be upset. I don't want to think I ruined it for her. I couldn't focus myself on May when everything around me was shimmering frost and moonlight. Maybe I was still half asleep. Do you ever come over here in the morning early like this? May shook her head. I don't think she was even looking at the house, how beautiful it was rising out of the darkness. For the most part, I had stopped seeing it a long time ago, but every now and then something would happen, something like this, and my eyes would open again, and I would see it there, enormous, preposterous, spectacular. A brigade of nutcrackers would come pouring out of the dark hedges at any minute and be met by a battalion of mice. The lawn was sugared with ice. The stage at Lincoln Center hadn't been made to look like the Dutch house. It was that the Dutch house was the setting for a ridiculous fairy tale ballet. Was it possible our father had turned into the driveway that first time and been struck by the revelation that this was where he wanted to raise his family? Was that what it meant to be a poor man, newly rich? Look, Maeve said in a whisper. The light in the master bedroom had come on. The master bedroom faced the front of the house, while Maeve's room, the better room with the smaller closet, looked over the back gardens. Several minutes later, we saw the light in the upstairs hallway, and then the light on the stairs, like the first time Maeve had brought me back when I came home from Choate, but now the whole thing was happening in reverse. And the car, in the dark, we said nothing. 5 minutes passed, 10 minutes. Then a woman was walking down the driveway in a light-colored coat. While logic would suggest that it could have been a housekeeper or one of the girls, it was clear to both of us, even from a distance, that it was Andrea. Her hair, pulled back in a ponytail, was a brighter blonde in the moonlight. She kept her arms around herself, holding her coat tightly closed, the edge of something pink trailing behind her. We could see some slippers that might have been boots. It looked for all the world like she was coming straight for us. She sees us. Maeve's voice was low, and I put my hand on her wrist on the off chance she was planning to get out of the car. When Andrea was still a good 10 feet from the end of the driveway, she stopped and turned her face to the moon, moving one hand up to hold closed the collar of her coat. She hadn't stopped for a scarf. She hadn't expected the early morning dark to be so clear or the moon so full, and she stood there taking it in. She was 20 years older than I was, or that's how I remembered it. I was 42. Maeve was 49, soon to be 50. Andrea took a few more steps toward us, and Maeve slipped her fingers through mine. She was entirely too close, our stepmother, as close as a person on the other side of the street. I could see both how she had aged and how she was exactly herself, eyes, nose, chin. There was nothing extraordinary about her. She was a woman I had known in my childhood and now did not know at all. A woman who had, for several years, been married to our father. She leaned over, picked up the folded newspaper from the pea gravel, and, tucking it under one arm, turned away, walking into the frost-covered field of the front lawn. "Where is she going?" Maeve whispered, because for all the world it looked like she was headed toward the hedge that bordered the property to the south. The moon hung on her pale coat, her pale hair, until she passed behind the line of trees, and we couldn't see her anymore. We waited. Andrea didn't reappear at the front doors. "Do you think she's gone around to the back? That doesn't make any sense. It's freezing." It hadn't occurred to me until now that I was never the one driving when we went to the Dutch house, and that from this vantage point the view was suddenly changed. "Go," Maeve said. We stopped at a diner instead of going straight to the train station to pick up her car. And over eggs and toast, the same thing we'd eaten for dinner, broke down Andrea's trip to get the paper frame by frame. Had she seen something out there we couldn't see? Were those slippers or boots? Andrea had never gone to get the paper herself. She had never come downstairs in her nightgown, or maybe she had when none of us were awake. Of course, she would be living in the house alone now, Norma and Bright, whom we always thought as being so young must be in their late 30s by now. How long had Andrea been there alone? Finally, when we had exhausted every fact and supposition, May put her coffee cup down in its saucer. "I'm done," she said. The waitress came by, and I told her we'd take the check. Maeve shook her head. She put her hands on the table and looked at me straight, the way our father would tell her to do. "I'm done with Andrea. I'm making a pledge to you right here. I'm done with the house. I'm not going back there anymore." "Okay," I said. When she started walking towards the car, I thought I was having a heart attack. I felt an actual pain in my chest just seeing her again. And it's been how many years since she threw us out? 27. "Well, that's enough, isn't it? We don't need to do this. We can go someplace else. We can park at the Arboretum and look at the trees. Habit is a funny thing. You might think you understand it, but you can never exactly see what it looks like when you're doing it. I was thinking about Celeste and all the years she told me how insane it was that Maeve and I parked in front of the house we lived in as children, and all I thought the problem was that she could never understand. You look disappointed, Maeve said. Do I? I leaned back in the booth. This isn't disappointment. We had made a fetish out of our misfortune, fallen in love with it. I was sickened to realize we'd kept it going for so long, not that we had decided to stop. But I didn't need to say any of that because Maeve understood it all perfectly. Just imagine if she'd come to get the paper sooner, she said, say 20 years ago. We could have had our lives back. I paid the check, and we got in the car and drove to the parking lot at 30th Street Station. It had only been yesterday that Maeve had come to New York to see May dance. It could be said that by stopping at the Dutch House and then going to the diner, we had wasted the advantage we'd gained by getting up so early. There wouldn't be much traffic for Maeve going back to Jenkintown, but I would hit the full force of rush hour driving into the city now. I would do my best to explain it all to Celeste. I'd tell her I was sorry I'd been gone, sorry I was late coming back, and I would tell her what we had accomplished. Maeve and I agreed. Our days at the Dutch House were over. Part 3. Chapter 16. If Maeve gets sick, then you're the one who has to do the thinking, Jocelyn told me in the little apartment where Maeve and I lived after our father died. Don't let yourself get upset. People who get upset only make more work. Funny what sticks. There wasn't a week that went by, and probably not even a day, when her instruction didn't come back to me. I equated my ability to be effective with my ability to stay calm, and time and again it proved to be the case. When Mr. Otterson called me from the hospital to tell me that Maeve had had a heart attack, I called Celeste and asked her to pack me a bag and bring up the car. Should I come with you? She asked. I appreciated that, but told her no. Call Jocelyn, I said, because Jocelyn was on my mind. My father was on my mind. He had been 53. Maeve was 52. I thought less about his dying and more about the deal I'd struck with God when I walked out of my high school geometry class that day at Bishop McDevitt. He would spare Maeve, and in return, he could take anything else, anyone else. The small waiting room for the coronary care unit was hidden past the restrooms and water fountains. Mr. Otterson was there, looking like he'd been sitting in that same gray chair for a week, his elbows resting on his knees, his hair thinning and gray. Sandy and Jocelyn were with him. They had heard the story about what had happened, but they asked him to tell it again. Otterson had saved Maeve's life. We were meeting with an advertiser, and Maeve stood up and said she needed to go home, Mr. Otterson began in his quiet voice. He was wearing gray suit pants and a white shirt. He'd taken off his jacket and tie. No doubt she ignored whatever it was she was feeling for as long as possible. You know Maeve. We all agreed. They had left the meeting right away. He asked if her blood sugar was low, and she told him no, this was something else, maybe the flu. When I told her I was going to drive her home, she didn't say a word about it, Mr. Otterson said. That's how bad it was. They were two blocks from her house when he turned the car around and drove her to the hospital in Abington. He said it was intuition as much as anything. She had put her head against the window of the car door. She was melting, he said. I can't explain it. Had Mr. Otterson let her off at her house, walked her to the front door, and told her to get some rest, that would have been that. It was Maeve who told me the rest of the story when I saw her in recovery. She was still swimming up from anesthesia and kept trying to laugh. She told me Mr. Otterson had raised his voice to the young woman at the desk in the emergency room. Otterson raising his voice was like another man pointing a gun. Maeve heard him say, diabetic. She heard him say, coronary, though she thought he was only throwing the word around so someone would come and help them. It had never occurred to her that it was her heart. Then, finally, she could feel it, the pressure creeping up into her jaw, the room swirling back, our father climbing the last flight of concrete stairs in the terrible heat. Stop making that face, she whispered. I'm going back to sleep. They kept those rooms so bright, and I wanted to shade her eyes with my hand, but I held her hand instead, watching her heart monitor scaling slowly up and down until the nurse came and guided me away. I was calm through the night I spent in the waiting room. Mr. Otterson staying past midnight, no matter how many times I told him he should go. I was calm the next afternoon when the cardiologist told me she'd had a malignant arrhythmia during the placement of the stent, and they would need to keep her in the unit longer than had been expected. I went to Maeve's house to take a shower and a nap. I was calm, going back and forth from the waiting room to her house, receiving the visitors who were not allowed in to see her, waiting for the three times a day I could go and sit by her bed. I stayed calm until the fourth morning when I came into the waiting room and found another person there, an old woman, very thin, with short gray hair. I nodded at her and took my regular seat. I was just about to ask her if she was a friend of Maeve's because I was certain I knew her. Then I realized she was my mother. Maeve's heart attack had lured her out from beneath the floorboards. She had not been there for graduations or our father's funeral. She had not been there when we were told to leave the house. She wasn't at my wedding or at the births of my children or at Thanksgiving or Easter or any of the countless Saturdays when there had been nothing but time and energy to talk everything through. But she was there now, at Abington Memorial Hospital, like the angel of death. I said nothing to her, because no one should ever initiate a conversation with death. Oh, Danny, she said. She was crying. She covered her eyes with her hand. Her wrist looked like 10 pencils bundled together. I knew what happened when people explored their anger in hospitals. The hospitals got rid of those people. It didn't matter if their anger was justified. Jocelyn had told me that people who got upset weren't helpful, and it was my job to take care of Maeve. You were the doctor, she said at last. That was me. If Maeve was 52, that would make her, what, 73? She looked a decade older. You remember? She asked. I gave a slow nod, wondering if I should acknowledge even this much. You had a braid. She ran her hand over her short hair. I had lice. I'd had them before, but this last time, I don't know. It bothered me. I asked her what she wanted. She dropped her eyes again. She could have been a ghost. "To see you," she said, not looking at me. "To tell you I'm sorry." She rubbed the sleeve of her sweater over her eyes. She was like any old woman in a hospital waiting room, only taller and thinner. She was wearing jeans and blue canvas tennis shoes. "I'm so sorry." "Good," I said. "That's done." "I came to see Maeve," she said, rolling the small gold band on her finger. I made a mental note to kill Fluffy. "Maeve is very sick," I said, thinking I needed to get her out of there before Fluffy showed up to defend her, before Sandy and Jocelyn and Mr. Otterson and all the rest of them arrived to cast their vote on whether she should stay or go. "Come back when she's better. She needs to focus on getting well now. You can wait, can't you? After all this time?" My mother's head tipped down like a sunflower at the end of the day, down and down until her chin hovered just above the bony dip of her chest. The tears hung for a moment on her jaw and then fell. She told me she had already been in to see Maeve that morning. It wasn't even 7 o'clock. While I had eaten my eggs in Maeve's kitchen, a mother sat by Maeve's bed and the glass fishbowl of the coronary care unit, holding her hand and crying, laying the tremendous burden of her grief and shame directly on my sister's heart. She had gotten into the unit by the most direct means possible. She told the truth, or she told some of it. She went to the charge nurse and said her daughter, Maeve Conroy, had had a heart attack, and now she was here. The mother just arrived. The mother looked like she was a minute away from coding herself, so when the nurse waived the rules and let my mother in for a visit that was both too long and not in keeping with the unit's schedule, she did so to benefit the mother, not the daughter. I know this because I spoke to the nurse myself. I spoke to her later, when I could speak again. "She was happy," my mother said, her voice as quiet as a page turned. She looked at me with such tremendous need, and I didn't know if she was asking me to make this right or telling me that she had returned to make this right. I stood up quickly, and I left her in the waiting room, skipping the elevator in favor of the 5 flights of stairs. It was April and starting to rain. For the first time in my life, I wondered if my father might have loved my sister beyond the abstract and inattentive way I had always imagined he loved her. Was it possible that he believed Maeve to be in danger and so thought to keep her safe from our mother? I walked manically up and down the rows of cars. If someone were to look at the window of this hospital room and see me, he would say, "Look at that poor man. He doesn't remember where he parked." I wanted to keep my sister safe from our mother, to keep her safe from anyone who could leave her so carelessly and then reappear at the worst time imaginable. I wanted to attest to my commitment, to reassure my sister that I was watching now and no harm would come again. But she was sleeping. There is no story of the prodigal mother. The rich man didn't call for a banquet to celebrate the return of his erstwhile wife. The sons, having stuck it out for all those years at home, did not hang garlands on the doorways, kill the sheep, bring forth the wine. When she left them, she killed them all, each in his own way. And now, decades later, they didn't want her back. They hurried down the road to lock the gate, the father and his sons together, the wind whipping at their coats. A friend had tipped them off. They knew she was coming and the gate must be locked. A patient in the coronary care unit was allowed 3 15-minute visits a day, one visitor at a time. My mother went to Maeve's bedside for the next 2 visits, the regular morning visit and the mid-afternoon. The nurse came into the waiting room and told us Maeve was asking for her mother. I was allowed in at 7 that evening, and I understood that it was not a moment for petulance, confrontation, or discussion. No wrongs would be righted, no injustices examined. I would go in and see my sister, that was all. Though I had been a doctor for only a short time, I knew the havoc the well could unleash upon the sick. Maybe it was because a full 24 hours had passed since I had last seen her, and maybe it was because her mother's arrival had thrilled her, but Maeve looked better than she had. She was sitting in the single chair beside her bed, her monitors all beeping in accordance with her improved heart function. "Look at you," I said, and leaned down to kiss her. Maeve gave me one of her rare Christmas morning smiles, no guile, all teeth. She looked like she might pop straight up and throw her arms around me. "Can you believe it?" And I didn't say, "What?" And I didn't say, "I know, you're doing so much better," because I knew what she was talking about, and this wasn't the time to be coy. I said, "It was a big surprise. She told me Fluffy found her and told her I was sick." Maeve's eyes were shining in the dim light. "She said she came right away." And I didn't say, "Right away plus 42 years. I know she's been worried about